Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Our guest today is Curtis W. Freeman, a research professor of theology and Baptist studies and the director of the Baptist House of Studies at Duke University's Divinity School. Professor Freeman's research and teaching explores areas of free church theology. I'm guessing that free church doesn't mean that congregants don't have to tithe, but we're going to find that out. Curtis is author of numerous books on Baptist themes, including Contested Catholicity, Theology for Other Baptists, A Company of Women Preachers, Baptist Prophetesses in 17th Century England, and Baptist Roots, A Reader in the Theology of a Christian People. His most recent book, Undomesticated Dissent, Democracy and the Public Virtue of Religious Nonconformity, was released in 2017 by Baylor University Press, Sic'em Bears. Reverend Freeman also practices what he preaches and is an ordained Baptist minister, serves as editor of the American Baptist Quarterly, and sits on the Baptist World Alliance Commission on Doctrine and Christian Unity. We will link to Professor Freeman's books and some other interesting tidbits over at our website, so please go by and visit. And next week, tune in for a very big announcement, followed by a couple months of some interesting stuff that I'm sure you're going to want to listen to. Curtis, welcome to Research on Religion.
Hey, Tony. Thanks for inviting me.
It's a great thrill. I know that you are a listener to some of these things, so it's really nice to have you on finally. I have a question for you, though, about your biography. You talk a lot about free church theology, and is that about people sitting in the pews on Sunday and not having to toss anything in the collection basket when it comes around?
That would be like freeloader.
Freeloader church.
Actually, it just traces the idea that non-established, non-state churches have had. And so, you know, here in the U.S., since you're a politician, you study political science and you study the way that church-state relates, everybody in the U.S., all churches are free churches, based on the, you know, First Amendment. But, you know, there is a tradition that has said that there's something important about not having state establishment. And so that's kind of the groups that I'm interested in studying.
And that definitely is going to work into your new book, Undomesticated Dissent, here. You're taking in some new directions. I had to ask the question on free church theology because I was a member of a free Methodist congregation for a while, and I never dropped anything in, and they said, no, you're reading this all wrong. So, but anyways, let's talk about your book, Undomesticated Dissent. It's a really interesting one that has interesting origins and seems to be a bit of departure from your other writings that tend to focus more on theology. This work examines works of literature, specifically three, but it blends in a lot more throughout the book. And religious themes permeate these works to varying degrees, but there's a lot of stuff that we might not consider to be all that religious-y. Tell us how the book came about.
Yeah, well, so thanks. It came about a few years ago when I was taking a trip to England, and I was up visiting with a group. We were trying to go to Wesley's Chapel, which is on the north side. If you're down, you know, St. Paul's Cathedral area, and you just go north to the old city wall, then you come to Wesley's Chapel. But right across the street, there is a nonconformist burial ground. And I'd heard about it, but I'd never really paid much attention. And so Wesley's Chapel was closed by the time we got there, but someone said, well, Susanna Wesley is right across the street in the burial ground. You might drop over there. And we did, and it really caught my attention because it's not a huge cemetery, but there are 120,000 places that actually been identified. It goes way back to the time it was a plague burial depository, but it was a place for dissenters. Essentially, if you weren't buried in a churchyard, you weren't a member of the Church of England, then you could be buried here in this churchyard. And right in the very center of it, which is what caught my eye, there are three memorials. There's one to John Bunyan, the 17th century Puritan, author of The Pilgrim's Progress, one to Daniel Defoe, who most people would recognize for, you know, his work of fiction, you know, Robinson Crusoe, but he did a lot of other things, and he was Presbyterian, trained for the ministry, but ended up being a merchant, and then William Blake, who was a poet and a painter and a printer, mainly, which is, but they all are memorialized in the center courtyard. And so I got to wondering, why were these three memorials there? Why did they choose to put them there? And it just sort of led one thing to another to telling the story about the three through their three main notable works, which actually Bunyan and Defoe end up being the most published books in the English language, which is kind of interesting. And then Blake is interesting in his own right, but so that's how the book came about, and I just, you know, kind of played with it. The more I played with it, just seemed to sort of tell its own story.
It is neat because I didn't know some of this stuff about specifically William Defoe. I know Robinson Crusoe and the other works, religious stuff that he has is not as familiar with me, but we'll be getting on to that. The other thing that I learned too, the cemetery that you walk through, you didn't mention the name, but it's called Bunhill Fields. And the really cool thing that I learned about this is that Bunhill, instead of being rabbits on a mound or something, Bunny Hills, it actually stands for Bone Hill, which just like bones and people buried in the hill. So that was kind of just an interesting way that name came about.
Yeah. No, it is an interesting, the English kind of shorten things. And so bone becomes bun and... So yeah, it's an interesting place. I was there just a few months ago, giving a kind of a book launch at Wesley Chapel, and I was actually staying in the manse in Wesley Chapel. So every morning when I'd wake up, I was on the third floor. I'd look out over Bunhill Fields, and it was really cool to sort of wake up that way.
Well, it's cool that you actually did that, because I think if I was scheduled to go to Wesley's Chapel and it was closed and somebody says, why don't you go to the cemetery across the street? I'd go, nah, is there a Dunkin' Donuts around or something? I don't know. So good for you for doing that.
There is a pub down the street.
Well, that
I would go, Angel.
I would go to that. Yeah, that sounds more angelic to me, so more lively. One of the other things you note about this cemetery, this Bunhill Fields or Bunhill Fields, is that G.K. Chesterton noted that this is often called the democracy of the dead. What does that mean?
Well, that's a line that comes from one of Chesterton's essays it's really saying that we should pay attention to the tradition, to the people who've gone before. And just because they're not around knocking on our doors, they're still living, and in a lot of ways through their works and through the things they've created and left behind. And so, you know, we should pay attention and listen to them. And weigh out what they said and their views on things as much as we do our own new ideas.
Well, let's start doing that and see what these folks in Bunhill Fields have to tell us. The book title again is Undomesticated Dissent. And before we head into the three authors that you mentioned earlier, Blake, Defoe, and Bunyan, let's deconstruct your title a little bit and tell us what you mean by dissent. Your scholarship covers a time frame from roughly the early years of the 17th century in England up through the first decades or so of the 19th century. So set the table for us with respect to what dissent during this time frame means.
Right. Well, it was a time, and roughly those dates correlate to the restoration of the monarchy in England. There was a brief time that there was a civil war, and people may know about Oliver Cromwell, the if you're a royalist, you would call it the interregnum between the kings, the kingdoms. But Protestants would call it the protectorate, perhaps the Commonwealth. And it lasts from the restoration of the monarchy from 1660 about to the time of the abolition of the recusant and dissenting laws that were in place to sort of keep people who were non-Church of England people out of the universities, pretty much out of politics. Couldn't serve as officers in the military. So it correlates between that time period. And that's a time that is kind of a strange one for us, because we wouldn't think today that just the church that people go to would determine whether or not they could go to the university. But, you know, in fact, that was the case at that time. And so a dissenter was basically, you know, someone who was not a part of the Church of England. And, you know, that went from everyone from Presbyterians that were sort of the closest to the Church of England all the way to Quakers and some very eccentric groups on the fringes, and Baptist and independent Congregationalists would be somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, you mentioned a number of these, and there's I'm familiar with the dissenting tradition in England, and the Shakers and the Quakers and the Congregationalists or Puritans. But one that you mentioned was the Muggletonians. I had never heard of that, and I said, oh, this has got to be, you know, like worshiping Harry Potter or
right.
The Muppets or something. How did you come across the Muggletonians?
Well, the Muggletonians are an interesting group. There's a tailor, a kind of a strange fellow named Ludwig Muggleton in the 17th century, and he would have been sort of okay, and people like this in America seem today to get along just fine, but he became convinced, kind of the way that somebody like David Koresh was, that he was a last day prophet. He saw himself as the fulfillment of one of the two prophets mentioned in the book of Revelation, chapter 11, that would come to, you know, announce the end of the world and so forth. And so he had a small group of followers and left some writings. He died, but it was a kind of let's just say very eccentric, and they had some very strange ideas. And there actually have been some that have connected Blake with the Muggletonians. E.P. Thompson, the great social historian, wrote a book about that. I think there are a lot of interesting connections and ideas that may be similar, but I think it's just kind of almost coincidental. But they are quite an interesting group.
Yes, the apocalyptic imagery of this Muggleton guy is rather interesting, but the apocalyptic imagery tends to permeate different sects of dissenters in varying degrees as well. How important is this apocalyptic imagery during this time?
Well, I think it's hugely important, and that was one of the things that I tried to write about in the book. So if you can, and really is what I was trying to do in the title, talking about undomesticated dissent, that part of what the establishment was doing was trying to make sure that there was a steady workforce, a working class. And this is something that E.P. Thompson and Christopher Hill and others have written about for a long time. But the apocalyptic piece of it is something that I think is really, really important, because it is what makes these dissenters resist the domestication, really to domesticate something. If you think about you spend a lot of time out. You said you live out in the countryside, and I'm sure there are a lot of wild animals around you, wolves and things like that. And you can actually tame a wild animal, but taming something is different than domesticating. Domestication requires breeding and taking the kinds of desirable qualities and bringing those out in a process over generations. And so, in a sense, what I was trying to point to is how the sort of gentrification of polite culture, English culture, established church culture, political culture, was trying to have this steady workforce to kind of make sure that things in the economy got done, and to keep it in place. But the danger was that you had some of these kind of people that were just a bit too wild, and that was when they're what I call the apocalyptic imagination goes out of control. So there's that threat. And the positive side of it that I see is how this apocalyptic imagination, which is about really bringing to an end the powers that be and putting something new in place, the new Jerusalem, and building that, which is what all of them in some way imagine. And that is not only a dangerous side, because it can go way out of control and get kooky, as we've seen, but it also becomes the powerful imagination for creating new structures. And really, I think it's what leads to an experiment like America, that religion and politics get wrapped up. And I mean, that's my contention in the last chapter, is how, you know, you see the New England Puritans imagining this new America as a kind of new haven, the new heaven. Connecticut, you know, is a place to start this kind of thing out again. I tried to play with that theme throughout the book and try to show how it has different iterations, some, you know, very dangerous and some actually very constructive.
Yeah, the subtitle of your book is Democracy and the Public Virtue of Religious Nonconformity, and I think you hinted at this to some extent, but what do you mean by the democratic nature of this undomesticated dissent, and why would it be considered a public virtue?
Yeah, so that's a good question. That was one of the things that the publisher put. They said, well, you need to really play with this theme a bit more. I guess I wanted to be a little more subtle with it. But what I see is that and this is what I tried to do a little bit in the last chapter, is to show how this religious imagination for creating a kind of covenant community, which is the theme that most of these dissenters had, because they didn't have the established church, they didn't have a king or a queen that was sort of the head of this church. They just had individuals, people that were gathered together in covenant. And so that idea, really, you begin seeing that come out in the New England Puritanism, and which is not the only strain of America, but it was certainly a very influential one in American democracy, of trying to figure out how we can have a community that cares for one another. And then on the same side of that, having this not just a covenant community, but something that is an inclusive community for all. And it's not just about caring for your own, but it's about, recognizing that there are people beyond the covenant that need to be brought in. And that's always the tension in this. And sometimes it really works well, and sometimes it doesn't. But, this is one of the things that I see as a really important and missed theme in American politics, is how this religious imagination provides the imagery to build something new. And you can certainly see people like Abraham Lincoln that draw on this theme, kind of a prophetic imagination. You see Martin Luther King and others that do that. So while we do have an official separation of church and state in America, we certainly don't have a separation of religion and politics, and I don't think we should.
Yeah, those things tend to go in opposite directions. If you have church and state aligned tightly, the powers that be want to control or domesticate
right.
the church. But if you don't, then you get undomesticated dissent in all its various forms. And the neat thing that you do in the final chapters, you bring this the home to the shores of America. But your three primary chapters, empirical chapters that deal with the authors John Bunyan, William Defoe, and William Blake are very interesting to us, because if we look back today, we say dissenters. I mean, they're kind of in the canon of English literature now. What's the big deal here? But it is interesting to go back and look at how they churned the waters quite a bit and challenged notions of the day in such a way that it led to the fabric of society that we have right now.
Right. No, I agree, and you know, they did it in very different ways, and they were very contextual. You know, Bunyan, who was imprisoned for his religious views, and spent actually 12 of his 60 years in prison in Bedford and in a jail, and he was able to leave and visit his family some, but still to spend 12 years in jail for your religious convictions is a remarkable thing. And so for Bunyan, his religious dissent, rather than leading him like it had done many of his contemporaries, and he had actually fought in the New Model Army, the Parliamentary Army, against the Royalist forces, and with Cromwell, he turned his back on that, and he began to imagine dissent in a very allegorical and almost psychological way. So that he was able to, the way he begins this story is with a dream. You know, he lies down in his jail and he begins to sleep, and he calls it a den, like Daniel in the lion's den. And he dreams, and in his dream he begins to see this journey, and he is able to imagine a world that is beyond his jail. And in fact, the only books that he had with him during that time was the Bible and the Fox's Book of Martyrs, where he would read this, and so he spins this allegory about that. But his religious dissent turns very much inward, whereas with the others, with Defoe and with Blake, it turns in a very different direction.
Let's return to Bunyan in just a second here, but I want to ask, why did you choose those three authors to specifically focus on, Bunyan, Defoe, and Blake? I know they're kind of prominent up there on Bunhill Fields, but is there another reason why these three are really representative? Because there could be a lot of other dissenters you could have chosen,
right,
from.
Well, I was really trying to just go with what that vision of that evening had given me of seeing these three memorials, and they're really the Bunyan memorial is a much more Victorian kind of thing that you would expect. The Defoe is this large obelisk at the other end, and Blake's is a very small headstone. But Bunyan I knew well, because I had been reading Bunyan since I was a child. I don't know if people read Bunyan much anymore. And I had read Daniel Defoe. I guess everyone would have read Robinson Crusoe, and I read some of his other novels as well, which were never quite as successful. But I like those. Blake, I didn't know well at all, and I've just become fascinated with Blake since writing the book, or in the midst of writing the book. But I had a personal interest in those two, but I really think it was just the why were these monuments here, and what story were they trying to tell by placing them there? Is it that sort of thing. So it just, the most interesting part of it to me was actually looking at the reception history and trying to trace out ways in which these books and the sort of encoded message of dissent within them was carried. And one of the most interesting pieces of that was this Taiping Rebellion, which you had this very strange American missionary that took Bunyan and the Bible to China, and it gets picked up in this very strange Taiping dynasty that was a kind of strange mixture of this kind of Puritan Bible reading, but also, you know, this very, very Chinese structure. And it led to this huge war where, you know, several million people were actually killed. But, you know, that would... It kind of plays out that apocalyptic imagination just in a different context, same way with Jamaica and the slave revolt there, where it was the missionaries that brought the Bible and Bunyan again. And so that's a theme that I wasn't expecting when I read the book, is to see how, when these books get read, they get taken up and, you know, things happen.
Yeah, and I just realized I've been saying William Defoe, not Daniel Defoe.
Right.
Which is okay.
Everybody knows your audience probably knows William Defoe better than Daniel Defoe.
Oh, I know. When I write these questions up, I read the book and I write them up. I guess I was just drifting off to Hollywood for a little bit there. But Daniel Defoe, I will correct that, folks. I know somebody will eventually email me and tell me that, but I've had you off at the pass. Let's return to John Bunyan. We've talked a bit about him in scattered pieces here. You mentioned that he had fought in the British Civil War. You've mentioned that he spent some time in prison and that his book was carried over to China to inspire this very interesting Taiping Rebellion, which was a huge, as you mentioned, a major movement, millions of people. It's just amazing. But give us a sense of Bunyan's life in his time. His masterpiece, A Pilgrim's Progress, how does that come about, and what is he representing? The title of the chapter there is called A Slumbering Descent. So explain all that.
Yeah, so Bunyan is... He fights in the Model Army, the new Model Army, with you know, the Cromwell forces. They defeat Charles I, the king. Actually, they're trying to figure out what to do with Charles, and you know, this is where this kind of apocalyptic imagination can go crazy, and it did. And so they were having debates what to do with Charles, and Bunyan's not a part of this. It's actually the generals and all they are trying to seek advice, and they become convinced that that King Charles is the little horn of the beast mentioned in Daniel, the book of Daniel, and in Revelation. So they decide that if they kill the little horn of the beast, then the millennium, the coming of Christ and all will happen, and they'll, you know, step into this new age where there'll be the reign of saints on the earth, you know, in Christ and for 1,000 years. And so he had been through that, and those dreams were crushed after Cromwell actually died, and his son was not able to keep the Commonwealth going. And so you have the restoration of the monarchy, and Bunyan, because he will not refuse to preach, you know, he was a dissenter, and so he would go out into the open air and preach, and he was brought before the magistrates, and they told him to stop preaching, and he refused, and so he spent 12 years of his life in jail. It really is how Bunyan's imagination translates that apocalyptic imagery to not a struggle in the world, but actually a struggle within his own soul, and a spiritual struggle for the lives of people. And so it enables him to imagine the world in a very different sort of way. And so it also is what enables these dissenters, rather than just taking that and translating it into direct political action, to have a kind of spiritual and religious faith that can exist quietly, and dissent can be something that is able to coexist in the society that is not of their choosing, which becomes, and so the slumbering dissent is to sort of talk about how the fiery the image that Blake, one of the powerful poems that he writes in the Songs of Innocence, is called the tiger. Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the darkness of the night. And the tiger is this sort of raging, apocalyptic, powerful rebellion that is, you know, within this imagination. And Bunyan is able to take that apocalyptic tiger and, you know, it goes to sleep, or it begins to struggle within the soul and not out in the world in the same way. So, so after he's released from prison, you know, he becomes a very, you know, prominent. His life before that, he, you know, they these dissenting ministers didn't make much money, so he spent his time working as well, and kind of bivocational as a tinker, which meant he traveled around and fixed things. And he would go to these big manor houses. There's a big one that he writes about, the Hill of Difficulty, which is in Ampt Hill, which is just up the way from Bedford. And, you know, he would go there, and when they had broken things, pots and pans and other sorts of things, he would fix them. But, you know, in addition to that, he was a minister of a gathered church that was there in Bedford, and it still exists to this day. It's called the Bunyan Meeting in Bedford. So that's a little bit of his story. But he wrote a lot, you know. Most of them are, you know, sermons and other sorts of things like that. And he's in a lot of ways a very typical Puritan. But the thing that is, I think, really unique about him is the way in which he is able to take this kind of allegorical style of writing and put it in a kind of everyday language. So it's certainly not Milton, but I would say sometimes that that Pilgrim's Progress is a kind of it's kind of a prose epic for the common people.
Yeah, tell us about A Pilgrim's Promise, because my son read it in high school. I don't remember reading. I went to a public high school, so we didn't read it there. How does this all fit into the times there? Because we today might read it as just part, as I mentioned before, part of the Western canon. We don't really situate it as seeing this as dissenting. What role does it really play in the 17th century and perhaps even a little bit later in British life?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting piece. There's, and I do a little bit of analysis, not near as much as that you could, but there's one particular story that I focus on. You know, it's an allegory, and so it if you try to track it in a linear way, that it doesn't really fit. It doesn't have a kind of a plot, except the plot is, you know, he leaves the city of destruction and he goes to heaven and to the celestial city, and then he has all these kind of adventures along the way, along the journey, you know, and it really, the journey is a journey of his own salvation, that struggle that's going on within his soul, and that's a very typical Puritan kind of theme. And you see others that play with this kind of imagery as well. But what one in particular that I really find striking is he's traveling with a friend named Faithful, and everybody's name you know, describes kind of who they are in this allegorical way. So Faithful is his fellow spiritual pilgrim, and they go to this city called Vanity Fair. And in the city, you know, it's a fair, it's a kind of a English market town. And when they go there, they are immediately recognized as strangers. And the first thing that they're recognized by is their clothing, and then their plain speech, and the way that Bunyan describes the fine. The magistrate is really like the magistrate in his own town, that you know, put him in jail. And it's the very kind of language that you would hear the gentry and giving to the common people like Bunyan. But it, you know, he's described as this gentryman, this magistrate is described as a gentleman in his fine clothing, and yet here Bunyan has, you know, very plain clothes and plain speech, and so you get this very distinct class difference that still, to this day, you know, is really in England probably one of the biggest dividing lines between working class people and you know, people that are more established, you know, gentry, and it's more subtle than we find in the U.S., where race tends to be one of the things that marks our divide. But there it was class, and class was also associated with religion. So that there's this Defoe says that the distinctions sometimes, you know, you can say that they're that it's Cavaliers and Roundheads, or it's Whigs and Tories. But he said the real division has always been church and chapel. But those are also social divisions. The chapel, the free churches were associated with the working class, whereas the established church, the Church of England, was, you know, the gentrified people. And you know, it doesn't mean that there aren't working class people in the Church of England. There weren't at the time. There certainly were, and there are today. But they do sort of serve as a kind of marker, and Bunyan plays with that throughout the book.
Let's move on to the next one as well, and that is Daniel Defoe, and I corrected myself
right. This
time, Daniel Defoe. And this was an interesting chapter, because I do remember reading Robinson Crusoe as a kid, and I often thought it was the pilot script for Gilligan's Island. But this one comes across in your book as being the most secular authors, but this is a tale about religious rebellion kind of at its heart. So give us a tale about the undomesticated descent of Daniel Defoe and why you call it prosperous descent.
Right. So Defoe has a really interesting story. Defoe was trained in a dissenting academy. It was actually it was the same dissenting academy that that John Wesley's father was trained in, so you see those kinds of connections that run through the Wesley family and on. Defoe actually was training at the time, he thought, to be a Presbyterian minister, along the way, he got interested in politics. He found that he was quite good at writing kind of political tracts and news column type things for the newspapers, and so he began to do that and hired himself out writing tracts and that sort of thing. And then along the way, he also realized that he had a knack for business, and so he became a merchant, which was really how dissenters, it really this the division in the old economy, which was a kind of agricultural economy, an economy that was based in the land, began to give way to this mercantile economy that was in the sale of goods. And so that was the way that dissenters could rise up in the social ranks, by not having land, but they could have, they could make things, so it was a movement away from this old guild economy toward the merchant class. And Defoe became very successful, very prosperous in that, and he invested in all sorts of things in trade. Made a fortune, lost fortune, spent time in jail and out. But he was early in his life. He was involved in the rebellion against the king, the Monmouth rebellion, where there were a lot of dissenters that you know, were actually killed in that battle, but then tracked down and put to death or imprisoned. And he escaped from that and was never caught or tried for it. But he always identified with that kind of marginal politics, even though he oftentimes found himself mostly writing for and supporting Tory politicians, which would be the conservative rather than the liberal party. But he always identified with the working class and so forth. So because he was front, that was who he was, and yet he had risen up, as it were, kind of pulled himself up by his own bootstraps in this merchant economy and the opportunities that happened. So what Robinson Crusoe does is it kind of smashes up those themes of the kind of rising kind of capitalist economy that was emerging at the time, and how one man could go off and on his own island and just kind of start the world anew. And in fact, I think one of the footnotes, probably no one would bury themselves down in those footnotes as much, although they're at the bottom of the page, so you can read them fairly easily. I tell the story about how my grandfather, my great-grandfather, gave a copy of Robinson Crusoe to my grandfather when he was 10 years old at Christmas. And my great-grandfather had been a Presbyterian, and then had started a business and gave it this to his, his son, I think trying to encourage him to say, be a kind of a good model working class person like Robinson Crusoe, and you too, can be prosperous. And so he carried on with the family business as well. But it was a kind of way of kind of moral education with a kind of religious overtone to it.
Yeah, it's surprising for us to think about this now, how a merchant like this could actually be a dissenter in many regards. We think, well, they're the wealthy people and that, but at the time, this is when feudalism was really breathing its last breaths, and you had what you called polite society or the aristocratic society really looked down upon merchants because they were the ones that were churning the waters and creating a new society, and they were oftentimes very suspicious of what they were doing, upsetting the old traditions, so to speak.
Right, and the kinds of associations it brought you in connection with that were across country lines and all that, they found out, well, the Dutch have wonderful cloth, and we can, sell this to, to the English, wealthy, and so let's get this cloth and sell it, and, or whatever. But it would bring you into kind of political connections that wouldn't normally be made.
Yeah. How much of Defoe's religious upbringing really follows through his writings? You don't tend to see it too much in Crusoe, but is it present in other places, or do we need to dig a little bit deeper in Crusoe as well?
Well, I think you do. If you don't have to dig that deeply into Crusoe, because a big part of Crusoe is, and I think I track this a little bit in the book, are these three moments in which he opens up the Bible, and this verse from the Psalms just kind of opens up to him. It's just like you open the Bible and you read it, and God is speaking to you, and it tells him, to seek the Lord. And so, this is a kind of conversion experience for him, and really the whole story, if you really look at it, Tony, is the story of the prodigal son, of how, his father, he's a middle class family, and his father tries to tell him, do something respectable with your life, and he says no. He wants to go and he wants to sail the sea, and so he rejects that, and he actually quotes really a kind of kind of reflection on the prodigal son when he leaves his father, and he has this first storm that's a kind of a sign of things to come. But it really is how he goes away, leaves, goes into the far country, and then he comes back. But, you know, there's that, and it's like also he plays with the book of Job. That so, like, after all of this, he gets more than he had to begin with. So it has these religious themes, but they're for really, and you're probably familiar with, I think most of your listeners are familiar with, you know, this whole idea of the Protestant work ethic, and this is really a kind of example of that, of how if you work hard and you live a good, clean life, then God will bless you. And that really is kind of the theme of this story. And it's really how prosperity is the sign of God's providence.
Yeah. Interesting how those themes come back. You know, when you read this stuff as a kid, you just focus on the adventure story part of it. You know, how he builds a cave and, oh, I can do that, you know, out in the woods back by us. But yeah, you know, the story is sitting there, and it does come back to remind you of things later in life, which I think is really kind of neat. All right, last we come to William Blake, who is probably the least known of the three, and as you admit, too, you weren't all that familiar with him when you took up this project. He's a poet, he's a painter, he's a printer. Tell us about his story and why you associate him with apocalyptic descent.
Yeah, well, so in a lot of ways, I really didn't know that much about Blake. I had read, of course, probably most everyone has read Songs of Innocence, Songs of Innocence and Experience, which are, you know, kind of children's poems, but they're really not. They're really deep political images there once you get into the mind of this guy. But Blake was as a young man had aspired to be an artist, to be a painter. He was a working class guy, and he just always found that his opportunities were kind of stopped. He was not able to go on to study at the Royal Academy and like some of his friends. And he took up the trade of printing, and you know, this is how he was known. He engraved for, you know, books, and that's how he made his living. But his real interest was both a kind of combining of this engraving and painting in a style that he actually invented, which you to engrave, and some of the listeners may have seen this, but like if you engrave on copper plates, you have to engrave them in a negative image, right? And so then when you ink them and print them, they'll come out in the positive. But what he didn't, if you've seen the Blake images, he didn't just use TypeScript and illustrate them. He actually engraved his handwritten, like the poems themselves, on these copper plates. And then he did something even more amazing, which he would paint the plates with, you know, these colored ink, and he had to do it very, very quickly. They were small plates, very, very small, not much larger than a postcard. But he would paint them very quickly, and then he would set them up and print one page at a time. So each version is absolutely unique. So he was actually, combining the engraving and the painting as well as his own poetic style. So that's the really fascinating thing. And so if you really want to read Blake, you really need to get one of the illustrated versions and look at the ways in which actually the wording fits into the illustrations themselves. They really tell that story. The reason they're apocalyptic in my mind is that Blake is an absolutely apocalyptic thinker in this poem, which is his masterpiece, Jerusalem, is, it's taken from the image of Jerusalem in the book of Revelation. I saw the new Jerusalem coming down from heaven and in the end of Revelation. And so his idea of that is that London in his time, and this was right at the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution, and you can just imagine the soot, you know, covering the buildings, and it was a time when there was all kinds of these poor children, the chimney sweeps that he writes about, that this was just taken as a kind of an expected thing to keep society running. And Blake sees this as, you know, a kind of apocalyptic image, and what he imagines is that beneath this there can be a beautiful city that can be built, and that if we would just imagine, what he uses this image of the churches being blackened, the cathedrals being blackened, and that's an image not just of the Industrial Revolution and the way that there's a kind of desecration of the goodness of God's creation, but he imagines that there can be a new creation that emerges from this, and I open the that chapter by telling the story of the very first factory, mechanized factory was in London, called Albion Mills, which is a huge flour mill, and it takes these steam engines to run these huge grinding stones, but shortly after, a couple of years after it was built, it mysteriously burned, and Blake writes about this in several of his poems. But that image of how the imagination can see things being destroyed, but also in the midst of this destruction, the emerging of a new creation, a new Jerusalem that has to be built. And so that's really the theme of the poem, of how kind of politics and religion all wrapped up in the Book of Revelation is, he calls it the whore of Babylon and all those things, but he sees emerging this sort of Christ-like figure that is within us, within Albion, which is every human being, and that this emerging of Albion, which is really the image of Christ in every person, if we would just follow that, then we could create build this new Jerusalem here on earth. And that's the kind of theme that I see politics, this sort of religious politics at its best, is how politicians are able to do that. And you take someone that I find, in fact, will be one of the main figures in the book I'm working on right now, is Abraham Lincoln, how he takes these same themes, and he sees from the Civil War this terrible thing that's happened, and yet from that he sees the seeds of a new, really a refounding of America, and it's a religious vision based on forgiveness, and that's the kind of thing that Blake is talking about in Jerusalem.
Your final chapter takes the theme of descent overseas and into the soil of colonial America, and you address a wide range of characters, not just one focus, but from John Winthrop to Roger Williams, and you also roll the historical tape forward in the final few pages to mention such figures as Clarence Jordan, a relatively unknown preacher, and then Martin Luther King Jr. What are the lessons to be taken away from this chapter? How does this come overseas and affect our understanding of American history?
Well, I one of the images that I play with a little bit in that, and it's an image that you see both Blake and Bunyan use, and it's the image of Beulah Land. It's a very, very small image in, from the Book of Isaiah that talks about the women of Judah being called Beulah, which means that they'll be married, and it becomes an image for Bunyan and for Blake of a place that is not heaven, but it is. Bunyan calls it next door to heaven, and it's the sort of thing that you see or you hear in hymns. There's a gospel song that I quote in there called Beulah Land, and it's the sort of thing that when King has in Memphis, when he goes to the church the night before he's killed, and he talks about going up into the mountain, right? And he says, I've seen the promised land, and that's a Beulah Land vision. It's what people they have a vision of heaven. In Blake's mind, it's a time of sleep. And Bunyan does that as well, where he is able to imagine this place in his sleep, in his dreams. But this is what Lincoln does, you know, when he imagines a new republic. King does it, and I guess I'm still holding out hope that there's going to be a kind of prophetic-like figure in America that can imagine. How the world can be different and call us into that, but it really, what I say is that I think somewhere in that last chapter is that America has become a kind of Beulah Land of religious dissent, where we've invited all kinds of people here, and that, you know, this whole crisis that we have going on right now about immigration and so forth is really testing that. And you do see certain figures here in our state. There is a preacher that's actually a graduate of our school, William Barber, that has, you know, it has a kind of king-like vision of you know, seeing. He's called this new campaign the Poor People's Campaign, but they're very much involved in talking about immigration as well. And you know, that's the sort of Beulah Land vision that I think from Winthrop on, at its very best, is imagining how America can be a place for all people to come, and it can have a kind of knitted together commonwealth, but also an open community that's always ready for what, you know, Rhode Island was called. Roger Williams founded the Lively Experiment, that it's continuing to allow all sorts of people to come, and it really is about America as a kind of religious imagination as much as anything. So that was what struck me at the end of it, is how in a way our country has become the embodiment of the kinds of hopes and dreams that these dissenters were looking for. And I don't want to suggest that it is heaven, but at its best, I think it is something that could be next door to it, a place where there is opportunity for all, a place of friendship. But as I say, it can also go very wrong, and has in many times.
Yeah, you mentioned you hold out hope for a prophetic-like figure to come again, like a Defoe or like a Blake or like a Martin Luther King. And I think the important lesson that we take away from your book is that this is continually going on through history, and that understanding the history of dissent and the churning of society and religion's role in that churning is really important. And that's what makes it such a delightful book. Let me finish off here with a final question. And I have noted several times throughout the 8-year run of this podcast that scholarship isn't a destination that is concluded when your work finally makes it into print, but it rather is an ongoing journey with more paths opening up each time that you think you've arrived at a resting place. And you've already noted you're on your next book about Abraham Lincoln, so that journey seems to continue. But let me ask you a little reflective question here. Over the course of your journey now, what have you learned that has surprised you or that has most altered the way that you view the world?
Wow, that's a huge question. I think the thing that I have learned is that anything can happen if with a little imagination. And part of it is just paying attention. And I go back to the thing you said you would have gone to, you know, a pub or somewhere else, Dunkin' Donuts, you know, and maybe I would have too, but taking that extra step across the street and to stand there in that courtyard and just for a moment, it was kind of Beulah Land experience. Just an imagination in the fading light to see these three monuments and say, what story are they telling? And beyond just, you know, the images there and the words and the stones, but there's a story, an untold story. And I think there are opportunities that we have as scholars to do that all the time if we would simply just pay attention. And really, in a way, I would say that this book wrote itself. I tried not to get in the way, and I did at times, I'm sure. But it was a story that was just waiting to be told. And when I told a friend of mine who teaches at Oxford and has been to this cemetery many times, he said, why didn't I write that story? Because he, you know, he studies literature and theology, and he says, I should have written that book. And I said, well, yes, you could have probably written it better than I did. But this was a vision that came to me. It was an imagination that was mine, and I just sort of went with it. And so the surprising thing is, you know, what the human imagination can do if we would just simply open ourselves up to it. I think we become, the older we are, which is why I think Blake is so fascinating, is that he wants to call us back in some ways to the songs of innocence and the songs of experience, and to really have a kind of childlike look at the world that sees angels on every branch of every tree. You know, how do you do that? How do you see it? Well, you see it with the eyes of imagination. And so that to me, I hope, is the surprising takeaway that I've gotten.
Tell the untold story, and that has been a theme of Research on Religion here over the past 8 years, of finding wonderful stories like this that people often just walk by in a cemetery or walk by in the street and don't take notice. And it's absolutely wonderful when a scholar or just an average person stops and takes a moment to look and say, hey, that is really kind of interesting. There's a story there. Let's tell that story. My guest has been Curtis Freeman. Curtis, thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Tony, thanks for asking me to be here, and I will look forward to a sit-down visit with you when we can have a chat like this face-to-face.
Excellent. Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.